Welcome to this podcast of KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, Geraldine Brooks is an Australian-American journalist and author. Her novel, March, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2006. We're presenting the core of Brooks' talk here. If you'd like to hear her wonderful introduction by Seattle Arts and Lectures' Ruth Dickey, a poem from a student in Sal's Writers in the Schools program, and the Q&A session, you'll find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Geraldine Brooks' most recent work is The Secret Chord, a novel based on the life of King David. She was hosted by Seattle Arts and Lectures at McCaw Hall on January 28th. Thank you to Anna Tatasheff for our recording.
Look at you all. How amazing this is. You know, those of us who are novelists have all traveled this path where you go to the bookstore and if you're lucky there are five people and a dog. And I'm looking at you all tonight, and I am both profoundly grateful and so scared. It's wonderful to be here with you. So, many people collect things. Some collect stamps, some coins, some porcelain figurines, and some bobble-headed dolls. I collect examples of unhelpful signage. Watch for falling rocks. Who saw somebody crushed by a rock and thought, if we'd only had a sign? And yet, that sign is ubiquitous and still profoundly, utterly unhelpful. But it's the rare ones I really treasure. The ones you have to travel for, like a bird watcher in search of a blue-footed booby. Remote Australia has given me some of the most prized pieces in my collection. For example, I was with my husband, Tony Horwitz, when he was researching his book, Blue Latitudes, about Captain Cook's journeys around the world. And I went with him to Cooktown in far north Queensland. And then we decided we'd drive even further north, where roads are more an ideation than an actual reality. And we were driving along one of these concepts of a road, and I saw the profoundly unhelpful sign, drive according to prevailing conditions. Or perhaps even less helpful than that, at a place aptly named Big Hall in the Northern Territory. Accidents can lead to injury and death. No, really? Sometimes the sign on first look is useful. Over a highway in Massachusetts, texting while driving kills. Yes, so it does. Seems very sensible sign. Until you notice the asterisk. For more safety tips, text # safety. But perhaps the prize in my collection is on the car ferry to and from my home on Martha's Vineyard. For your safety, please exit the freight deck while the vessel is underway. Every time I see that sign, and I see it a lot, I have this mental image of SUVs with their bungee-corded extrusions of summer vacation pleasures, holiday paraphernalia, kayaks and bicycles and whatnot, driving obediently off the freight deck and plunging lemming-like into the cold waters of Nantucket Sound. It's one way to thin out the August tourist crowds. Why do I love these signs so much? I think it's because they remind me how magnificently complicated our language is and how difficult it is to convey precise meaning, no matter how sincere the effort. Someone went to a bit of trouble to make all of these unhelpful signs, to think up the message and have it printed eye-catchingly in high-vis lettering. Someone at Martha's Vineyard Steamship Authority, for example, merely wanted to advise people to get out of their cars. A modest directive, and yet they totally blew it. I keep little notes of these signs by the desk in my study. It's to remind me to be careful with this fragile treasure, our language. But like the Steamship Authority, I often blow it. The difference between the right word and the wrong word, as Mark Twain reminds us, is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. In historical fiction, the odds of missing the mark are especially high. If you put the wrong word in a character's mouth, you can pull the reader out of the time period. In my first novel, Year of Wonders, my young narrator waxes poetically about the mauve tide of the heather flowing across the mountainside of her 1665 village. Problem. The first use of the word mauve as a color wasn't until 1796. And it wasn't commonly used by people like my narrator until 1859. That's when mauve dye was invented in France and named for the French word for the mallow flower. And I know that because a year after my book came out, somebody helpfully wrote a book called Mauve, How One Man Invented a Color That Changed the World. Whoops. So just after that novel came out, I got some advice on this issue from the English novelist Jim Crace. He told me about a research trip he'd made for his novel, which was set in the biblical era and called Quarantine. So to research the novel, he went camping in the Judean desert with a Bedouin guide. And on the first morning, the guide woke him in his tent with a cup of wonderful cardamom-scented Arabic coffee. And he said, "Mr. Jim, how did you sleep?" And Jim Crace turned to him and said, "Ahmed, I slept like a log." And then he raised his eyes to the bare, rock-ribbed hillsides of the Judean desert. No logs. And he said, "Ahmed, how did you sleep?" And Ahmed said, "Mr. Jim, I slept like a dead donkey." Ever since then, I've spent a lot of time going over my manuscripts, trying to find logs and turn them into dead donkeys. In my recent book, The Secret Chord, for example, which is about King David and set in the Second Iron Age in Israel, I found a lot of logs. I had to take out the word assassin because I recalled that the original assassins were a violent Persian sect of the 11th century, and their name is related to their use of hashish. People in Second Iron Age Israel probably wouldn't be talking about 11th century Persians. So I used thug instead. Thug. Until I realized that thug refers to thuggee, a band of Indian robbers in the 15th century. And I never did come up with the dead donkey there, the perfect word. But sometimes you can find it, and it can be quite transporting. In Caleb's Crossing, my narrator needs to talk about a fetus. But in 1660s Massachusetts, I don't think my young Calvinist girl is using the word fetus. So I referred to one of my absolute most treasured reference books, the Oxford Historical Thesaurus of the English Language, in which you can dig down through vocabulary in use from modern day to early Icelandic. And if you look up fetus, you'll find that in the mid-17th century, the word that she would have been using is shapeling. And suddenly, when you put that wonderful, apt, evocative word in her mouth, you've time traveled. Does it really matter? Is this what fiction's about? Is it important? Or is it nitpicking? And I have to say, I've loved the aptness of the expression nitpicking ever since I actually had to do it. My kid got head lice in the third grade. It is extremely exacting work. And combing through a manuscript looking for bad vocabulary is in some ways very similar. And I think it does matter. I think it's respectful to you, the reader. Let me tell you why, and I'm going to digress for a moment back to 2005. I had to attend a math lecture, and it sort of seared into my brain because I dropped math the minute they let you drop it. But I was a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. And this is one of the world's fantastic boondoggles, I have to say. They pay you to go and do your own work that you'd be doing anyway without being paid extra. And you get to do it surrounded by total access to Harvard's libraries. Students, they pay them to research for you, to schlep your books back and forth from the library. And all you have to do in return is give one talk on what you're actually working on and go to the talks of your fellows. So one of them was a mathematician from the University of Bordeaux, and her lecture was entitled Singularities in Algebraic Plane Curves. I was not enthusiastic. I slumped into the lecture room, armed with a doodle pad, hoping to use the hour for personal reverie. I thought if I found a pillar to sit behind, that a short nap might not be out of the question. And on the pad I carried that day, I have a few fragments of the sentences the mathematician used. A formal power series about the origin is an infinite sum. Homomorphism is an isomorphism. If, and only if, the matrix is invertible. This is like poetry, I thought. and I leaned forward to hear more. The mathematician was eloquent. She was passionate. And when I set aside my firm belief that I couldn't understand a word she was saying, something strange happened. It wasn't that I understood her work, but I understood her vision. I realized I'd lived until that moment in an airlock, and she was prizing open the heavy door. Just a crack, and in that sudden brief shaft of light, I glimpsed a sliver of the world beyond, the world that she inhabited. When she looked at the old maple tree beyond the lecture room window, at the great swoop of bough arcing up from the trunk, her consciousness overlaid a pattern on that branch that was elegant and sensual. I could imagine for a moment what it was like to see with her eyes and to feel with her heart, to inhabit a space where the language wasn't particular and national, but infinite and universal. A world in which every object sang to her with its own particular music. And I know now that it's a beautiful world. But I also know that even if I visit, I can't live there. If she has lungs, I have gills. I swim in a sea of words. They flow around me and through me, and by a process that's not fully clear, some delicate hidden membrane draws forth what I need to live. But I am sure now that our work, the mathematician's and mine, it's essentially the same work. In her exploration of the singularity in every plane curve, she seeks a way to more perfectly describe that arcing branch, or a soaring bridge, or the quivering S-bend in a squirrel's upraised tail. She pushes her way deeper and deeper into the truth of the world. And this also is what I must try to do. So I didn't start out as a novelist. I had another career in mind entirely. I read a wonderful line from Henry David Thoreau, and mostly I agree with him, but this didn't quite sit right with me. He wrote that the youth gets together his materials to build a bridge to the moon, or perchance a palace or a temple on earth. And at length, the middle-aged man concludes to build a woodshed with them. It was exactly the opposite to me. I started out planning on building the woodshed, a nice, tight, serviceable structure that would serve a modestly useful purpose. I wanted to be a newspaper reporter in the city of my birth. Almost as long as I can remember, I had that ambition in mind. I would try to write stories that helped people. Perhaps every so often an article might right a local wrong, or even shift policy a few degrees in a more progressive direction. But then they'd end up lining the floor of somebody's hamster cage, and I was okay with that. And then in my 20s, unexpected doors opened to me, and my ambition enlarged a little bit. I started thinking that building that temple might not be out of the question. As a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, bearing witness in the dark and troubled places of the earth, I began to entertain a hope that my words might have an impact on the councils of powerful people. I hoped at least they'd be true and a valuable reflection of the history unfolding before my eyes, that first rough draft that historians and analysts would turn to later when they shaped a better understanding of our times. And then I hit middle age, and became a fiction writer. And my ambition slipped all reasonable bounds. Now, in middle age, I aspire to build that bridge to the moon. Like the mathematician, I'm after nothing less than eternal truth. What is this world? How can we more perfectly describe it? Who are we? And who have we been? And what can we learn from that? It's one thing to have the ambition. It's another thing to have the means. You might aspire to art. It doesn't mean you can make it. As my friend, the sculptor Sarah Z, said when asked to describe her process, mess, 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 art. But sometimes it's just mess. And sometimes it seems you'll never get past that. But the important thing is the effort. I don't, for example, believe in writer's block. Orthodontists don't have block. Neither do car mechanics. You get up and you go to work. I was a news reporter for 16 years, seven of them a foreign correspondent in the Middle East, in Africa, and the Balkans. And perhaps the most useful equipment I acquired in that time is a lack of preciousness about the act of writing. As a reporter, you have to write. There has to be a story. The mot juste on arriving? Tell that to your desk. Your editor won't wait for you to get your aura on straight. You file or you fail. So writing for me begins as craft. Words are my stones and I'm building a wall. And you choose each stone with consideration and you place it with effort. And sometimes you find just the right stone, the right shape and heft for that difficult niche, and the effect is beautiful and satisfying. Your wall goes up straight and true. Other days you pick up one stone and then another, and none of them is right. You try it. It won't fit. Frustrated, you cram it in there. And the effect is unsightly and the balance is precarious. You come back the next day and you can't even bear to look at it. You bring in the backhoe and you knock the bastard over. But the most important thing is the effort. There can't be a day without lifting stones. And after enough days, if you've sweated enough, if you've scraped enough skin off your hands, if you've been patient and diligent with your craft and unsparing in the use of that backhoe when required, you will have a wall. And it might even be a beautiful wall that'll last 100 years. So I learned to write fiction in stages. From being a newspaper reporter, I wrote a reporter's book, 9 Parts of Desire, a journalist's attempt to stand back from what I'd learned in 6 years living among the women of Islam, to take all the shards of experience written up in haste and the stories walked away from under deadline, and go back and consider. I had a year's leave of absence from my reporting job, and it took me almost a year to figure out how to write that book, to write something longer than a newspaper article. By trial and error, I eventually came up with a narrative strong enough to bind together my disparate experiences. My second book, Foreign Correspondence, was also nonfiction, but it was much more quirky and personal. It began as a sort of a memoir and a sort of a travel adventure about my childhood pen pals and my adult quest to find them and find out what had happened to them. But because it was written just after my father's death, it became a different book. As I was writing it, I realized that my real quest was to make sense of him and of my relationship to him. I can now, in retrospect, pinpoint the day that the seeds of becoming a novelist were planted in my head. But I didn't know it at the time. It was a beautiful day, pretty rare, an English summer day, and I was taking a brief break from reporting in the Middle East and hiking in the Pennine Mountains in England. And I came across a finger post that said the name of a village, Eam, and underneath it said, Plague Village. Not many places try to attract tourists by putting up signs saying Plague Village. But it worked for me. I hiked there. And in the village church was the extraordinary story about bubonic plague striking this little town in 1665. And the villagers, alone among all the people who'd been afflicted, took a unique decision that they would voluntarily quarantine themselves rather than do what everybody else did and flee, which resulted in spreading the infection. And so I walked out of the church where they told that story, and I had read that they, at the height of the plague, during this quarantine, when God seemingly wasn't listening to them, even though they had done what they thought he wanted to spare other people, but villagers were still dying, they closed the church and they held their services in a field where worshippers could stand apart from each other. So I went to that field, and in the play of the light through the leaves, I could see them standing alone, worshiping together, somehow, still willing to talk to a God who had asked so much of them and yet offered them no respite. The pale faces lifted towards the weak English sunlight, and they were haggard and weary and grief-racked and yet hopeful because they were alive and so many others had died. And I saw it so clearly. But I didn't run home and call the Wall Street Journal and quit my job. I didn't run up to the garret and start writing that novel. I went back to work, covering modern catastrophes. But all that time, the story of Eam and its crisis was on my mind. And I'd used the conduct of the people I was covering as a template to imagine it. Did the villagers of Eam act like this? Did crisis bring out their best self or their worst? Did one of them answer disaster with the kindness of this Kurdish man, the grace of that Eritrean girl? Or did they become as vicious and morally lost as that Baathist torturer or that Somali boy soldier? So the questions nagged at me, and eventually I sat down to try and answer them in fiction. And I started hearing voices, or one voice at least. The voice suggested in half a line from one of the Eam minister's few surviving letters, written just after his wife had died of plague. And in it, he mentions that his maid has survived and is attending to his needs. And that's all there is about her in the written record. Nothing has come down to us about that maid, not even a name. Yet her voice was very clear to me. And how she sounded told me who she was. And who she was told me how she would act. And that set the plot of my novel in motion. And something similar has happened in all my novels. Somebody rises up out of the grave and agrees to talk to me. It's hard to explain that, especially to young children. I remember vividly one day I had been playing with my kid, and once he was thoroughly involved in the game, I said, "Here, you take it from here. Mom has to go to work now." And I went upstairs to my study. And I think maybe as much as an hour later, I heard the footsteps coming up the stairs. And I had that feeling you have when you're being stared at. And I turned around and there he was. "You said you were working." "Mommy is working, darling." "No, you're not. You're just sitting there." "Well, darling, Mummy has to sit very quietly because she's trying to hear the voice of somebody who's been dead for 300 years. Straight back down the stairs. I thought that worked well. But it is like that. And it is very strange. So where do you go to hear their voices, to imagine how they might have expressed themselves? People who often didn't get a chance to, people who weren't literate, like the lead miners and the shepherds of that first novel of The Village of Eam, or the enslaved people of Virginia who were not allowed by law to learn to read and write. If they didn't set down their own words, how on earth can you hear them? Well, sadly, I learned you go to court. You'll find them there in every era. Women accused of being a witch because she was poor and alone, or a scold. My favorite, you could be charged and convicted for being a scold. And that meant you'd been overheard criticizing a man in public. I'm so glad that that one's not still on the books, because I don't think we'd have such a big audience here tonight. But if they took verbatim testimony, which they often did — they did this in the traveling British assizes courts, they did it in the church courts of New England, they did it during the Spanish Inquisition — if they took verbatim testimony, you hear people whose voices have otherwise been lost. And you recognize them. I recognize the women, particularly their anger, their sense of injustice, their awareness that she, as a woman, is getting a crook deal. And some critics have complained that my narrator's voices are too modern and too feminist. I urge them to go and read some 17th century court transcripts. But I don't think I'd be able to write the novels that I do if I hadn't had as a prelude the years of covering catastrophe. A foreign correspondent enters people's lives at the worst of times and mines them for the most terrible details. You write the story hoping that somebody who matters and who has some power will read it and give a damn. And then you try to forget about it so you can go on and do it all again. Some other war, some other person's desperate sadness. You try to clear the cache, but you can't. You can't drag and drop your memories. What is the price of experience? Asks the poet William Blake. Do men buy it for a song, or wisdom for a dance in the street? No, it is bought with the price of all that a man hath, his house, his wife, his children. Wisdom is sold in the desolate market where none come to buy, and in the withered field where the farmer plows for bread in vain. So I try to use the experiences that I had to make the suffering that I witnessed count for something. I do believe that fiction matters. I know it has power. I know this because the jailers and the despots are always so afraid of it. In Israel, in 1987, I interviewed and later befriended a 15-year-old Palestinian boy after he stoned my car on the road to Hebron. Not long after, his militancy landed him a 5-year sentence in an Israeli jail. And because he told me he loved English books, I tried to bring him a copy of Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea, thinking that the language was spare and simple and would be accessible to him. But the jailers wouldn't allow it. And I thought of that boy when Major Michael Morrie, the U.S. Marine attorney for one of the prisoners in Guantanamo, recounted how he had been barred from giving his client a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird. He also noted that in the few letters his client was allowed to receive, the word love was always redacted. These stories enrage me, but they also help me to get up in the morning. I'm glad that the jailers fear fiction. I'm glad they fear the power of small words. It encourages me to try harder, to give them something new to worry about. I'm not entirely sure why the journalist who wrote about what was happening here and now has become so attracted as a novelist to stories of the past, but it might be a case of symbiosis. Because I was an Australian of a particular time and place, I yearned to know the world, to travel and adventure abroad. And in my travels, I met an American man who never wished to leave his own shore, who would have dwelt contentedly in the archives that can be found in the Boston, Washington, New York corridor. That man loves history, but because of me, he was dragged around the world. And because of him, I was dragged into the past. So the moral, if any, is it's fun to sleep with foreigners, but be warned, this can change your life. In his 1936 classic for children, A Little History of the World, the Austrian author Ernst Hans Gombrich describes the business of writing about the past. It is, he says, like lighting a scrap of paper and dropping it into a bottomless well. As it falls and burns, it lights up the sides of the well, in the same way that our memories light up the past. And the deeper it falls, the less is illuminated. Living memory gives way to archives, archives to cave paintings to fossils, until the light goes out and everything is dark. But, as Gombrich writes, even in that dark silence, we haven't reached the beginning of the human story. Behind every beginning, no matter how long ago, there's another beginning. Every generation has its once upon a time. Your grandmother, her grandmother, her grandmother's grandmother's grandmother, and already we're back several hundred years. And every one of them probably telling stories that started with some version of once upon a time. I am proud and pleased to stand in that long line of storytellers. And I'm thrilled and delighted that all of you are prepared to make that journey with me. Thank you very much.
The That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum. You can hear the full version of this talk on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Geraldine Brooks' most recent work is The Secret Chord, a novel based on the life of King David. She was hosted by Seattle Arts and Lectures at McCaw Hall on January 28th. Thanks again to Anna Tatasheff for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.